All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is November 26th. So we got today's lecture. We're going to finish up respiratory system today, maybe move on to digestive system, and then next week two lectures, and then after that, the class is over. You just have the final. Don't forget the final is not cumulative. It's just over the remaining tests that you haven't been tested on so far. There's about five or six chapters there. Okay. But they're short chapters. Okay, so any questions over what we covered so far in respiratory system? Let's see. How can you break the respiratory system down? The two main components. The upper and lower. Yeah, exactly. So where does the, what's the line of demarcation between the upper and lower respiratory tracts? That would be the larynx, right? The larynx. So the larynx is the beginning of the lower respiratory tract. And I don't have it on this slide right here, but this basically is the lower respiratory tract minus the larynx. And, okay, so I think we got done talking about the trachea and the epithelium that lines it and how it branches. All right, well, you know, we got as far as bronchi, I think that's where we stopped. Bronchi, but there's smaller airways in the lungs. And those are what we call bronchioles. All right, so I'm going to zoom ahead a little bit to the next slide. All right, so in the conducting zone of the air passageways, all right, we have bronchi, right, and then secondary bronchi, tertiary bronchi. Bronchi, the main bronchi go either to the right or left lung. The secondary bronchi go to the different lobes of the lungs. And then the tertiary bronchi go to the smaller compartments of a lobe, and those are what we call lobules. And in each case, you should be aware that the left side, or the left lung, is always going to be smaller than the right one. So there are 9 lobules in the left side, but there are 10 on the right side, because you have to make room for the heart, of course. Okay, so everything in the lower respiratory tract, from the larynx down to bronchioles, contains cartilage. And that cartilage, the job of that cartilage is to keep those airways open all the time. Because a lot of times when you're breathing, and there are two different ways that people typically breathe. Right now, you're in a condition where we call quiet breathing. And the other kind of breathing is what we call forced breathing. So when you're exercising, you're using different muscles and different parts of your body compared to what you're using right now. So I'm going to mention this a couple times. But when you're forced breathing, you actually have to force air out of your lungs by compressing your chest, right? You have to contract your abdominal muscles and actually force air out of your chest by pressurizing your chest. And if the airways weren't held open all the time when you pressurize your chest to exhale, what would happen to the trachea if it wasn't held open by the cartilage? It would collapse, and then air would be trapped in your lungs, right? So those passageways for the lower airways have to be held open all the time, namely the larynx, the trachea, and the bronchi. Okay. Below that, in the bronchioles, they don't contain cartilage. They contain smooth muscle for controlling the diameter of these passageways, and airflow is controlled by adjusting the diameter of these passageways. So the first, so a bronchiole then is going to terminate in a terminal bronchiole, and then we get into the respiratory zone. There's a smaller tube called the respiratory bronchiole, and exchange can even begin to take place around a respiratory bronchiole. So there might be some capillaries that are surrounding these microscopic air passageways that feed air to the next smallest duct. This is what we call an alveolar duct. And then finally, an alveolar sac. That's a group of these little spherical-shaped objects that we call alveoli. So gas exchange can take place to some degree in all these different structures, but primarily it's going to be in an alveolus. That's just single for one of these spherical-shaped little objects. It's an air pocket. And it's specialized for gas exchange. So here is a nice micrograph of what a normal lung really looks like. So here you can see these little spherical shaped structures. These are specialized structures for gas exchange. So this is an alveolus. Here's an alveolus. Here's an alveolus. Okay, and then here's a respiratory bronchiole that's bringing air into these alveoli. So probably for you to appreciate what you're seeing here is, let's look at this illustration. So here is a terminal bronchiole that is feeding this alveolar sac right here via these respiratory bronchioles. And you can even see in a few cases that there are even alveoli coming off a respiratory bronchiole. But the major site of exchange is in this alveolar sac, because it's composed strictly of alveoli. And there can even be alveolar pores between neighboring alveoli, so that helps adjust pressure so that all the alveoli inflate together. All right, and you have about 300 million alveoli in your lungs, all right, in a normal, healthy lung. And that describes, or that gives you an appreciation of what the surface area is for exchange inside the lung. So when I say surface area, what kind of concept are we talking about when I say surface area? What does surface area mean to you?
Lungs.
Well, that's a
surface of the lungs.
It's a surface. Yeah. So surface area has something to do with surface. Like for instance, this piece of, say, if this was a piece of paper, what'd be the surface area of this piece? Ah, you in the back can't see what I'm holding here. What'd be the surface area of this piece of paper right here? It'd be, yeah, like 8 inches by 10 inches, or 8.5 by 11, something like that. And to figure out what the surface area is, you just multiply those two numbers together. Okay, that would be the surface area. Okay, but when I say surface area, I want you to understand what that means in a physiologic sense. I'm looking for a ruler. I thought I had a ruler in here. I don't have a ruler. Let me just go next door. Oh, yeah, here's one right here. All right, so I want to measure surface area of something. We could measure the surface area of this door right here. All right, and let's use this meter stick. Here's a meter. And so how would we measure the surface area of this door? It would be, yeah, the length times the width of this door would be the surface area. So let's see. It is, oh, look at that. It's exactly 1 meter wide. What a surprise. Okay, and how tall is it? Okay, so here's 1 meter, and here is 2 meters. Oh, look, it's exactly 2 meters. Okay, can you see that? Exactly 2 meters. So what's the surface area of this doorway right here? It is 1 times 2, which is 2 square meters. That's the surface area of that doorway, okay? And as a matter of fact, what is this doorway good for, this particular surface area of this door? It's a passageway. It's a way that people can move into the room, or people can move out of the room, or other objects. So a surface area, what I want you to think of a surface area is a passageway for exchange between two places, like in and out of a room, or in the case of the lungs, the surface area is the doorway where oxygen can get into your body and CO2 can leave. And that's the surface area. So when you think of this doorway, which is 2 square meters, how many people do you think can go through that doorway at one time? Mm-hmm. 2, maybe 3, something like that, right? But about 2 people. Now let's make that doorway bigger. Let's make it as big as a garage door, right, which is going to be maybe 22 feet wide by maybe 8 or so feet tall, probably a little bit taller than that door right there. How many people could go through a big garage door, double car garage? 2 or 3? How many? Oh, 20, 30 people can go through at one time. So as the doorway gets bigger, what can you tell me about exchange? More can happen, right? So it's directly related. All right, so we can take all these alveoli in the lungs, all 300 million of them, and flatten them out, like if you were to peel an orange or something, or a grape, and put the skin on a table, and flatten them all out, and fill in all the spaces with the alveoli, and measure what the surface area would be for all 300 million, and it would be 70 square meters. So if we were to take all 300 million, we'd get a surface area of 70 square meters, and does anybody have a feeling for how big that is? Of an object that you might be familiar with? I'm going to close the door. That would be about half of a tennis court. So that's half the size of a tennis court. That's the surface area of your lungs. So that's huge. So I personally can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall as a tennis court just so that I could breathe. So it's kind of nice that evolution has figured out a way to put that big, huge surface area in a very small space. And so how has evolution figured out how to do that? Well, it's still 70 square meters. But how did evolution figure out how to put a big surface area like your brain? What gives people intelligence, right, is the surface area of your brain. But what does the surface of your brain look like? It's convolutions. It's folded, right? So to get a surface area, a large surface area into a small space, you just fold it up. So the folds, right, or these functional spaces, alveoli right here, just allow for exchange to take place. It's a specialized structure for exchange. So for instance, you can make a filter out of a piece of paper like this, but if you didn't want to make it big, what could you do? To have the same surface area, but to put a big filter in a really small space, what could you do to a piece of paper? You could fold it up too, to make it fit in a small space. So that's the job of these alveoli right here. They're doorways for exchange. Okay. All right, so in order for exchange to take place, they have to be surrounded by a capillary network. And remember, capillaries are the only vessels where exchange can take place because the wall is very, very thin. It's just an endothelium, a simple squamous epithelium. And the alveoli expand and contract, allowing air to move in and out of them. So these red structures right here, oh, that reminds me of something I got to mention. These red structures right here are the capillaries, all right? But you see that there's something else surrounding every alveolus. Kind of looks a little blue. And these represent elastic fibers. So the interesting thing about your lungs and even the muscles that help you breathe is that once the alveoli expand in order to exhale, when you're breathing quietly, like you're breathing right now, that's just a passive exercise on your part. In order to exhale, you just have to relax muscles, and these elastic fibers around the alveoli are going to shrink the alveolus down, and it's going to have air exit your lungs. Okay, so you don't really need muscles to exhale when you're in quiet breathing. But when you're exercising, that's when you need muscles to exhale, so that you can exhale faster. And there are a lot of people that have disease in their lungs that attacks these elastic fibers. They can inhale normally, but guess what happens? They can't exhale. But in order to inhale again, what do you have to do? You've got to be able to exhale. So they have way decreased pulmonary function because they're missing these elastic fibers around the alveoli. So that's very important for normal functioning of the lungs. Okay. All right, so we're almost done with the alveoli. Not quite. Let's see a couple more slides. All right, so here is now a very zoomed in region. We're just looking at one or one and a half alveoli right here. So here's the wall of the alveolus. And you can see capillary beds that surround the alveolus. And this is the simple squamous epithelium right here that makes the wall of the alveolus. So this is the gas or the air-filled space inside the lungs, and there has to be exchange between the gas that's in the alveolus and the capillary bed right here. All right, so what kind of cells make up an alveolus? We got the simple squamous type cell, very, very thin, that allows for diffusion of gases. That's what we call a type 1 cell that makes up the wall of the alveolus. But I see another kind of cell in there as well. This one right here, this is what we call a type 2 alveolar cell, and it's special because it is secreting a special kind of chemical into the lung. Because the lungs are very moist, they're not really underwater, but they're filled with water, right, because we have a lot of water inside our bodies. And what can you tell me about water? Is water a slippery substance or is it a sticky substance? Slippery, or does it act like a glue? It's slippery. Okay, well, you know what? I got to change your opinion on that. Okay. It's not slippery. It's actually very sticky. Because of the properties of water, water molecules like to stick together. Okay, and because water molecules stick together, that gives water a property of surface tension. And maybe you've been out hiking in the woods someplace and you've come upon a pond or a creek or something, and you can even see insects walking right on the surface of the water because the insects are not heavy enough to push the water molecules apart to fall in. All right, but we're heavy enough to where that's not a problem. All right, we can push those water molecules apart. It's not that sticky of a glue. But for instance, you're probably familiar with that already because, I'll describe what I'm going to do right here. So how many pieces of transparency do I have right here? I should actually have photocopied something on them so that everybody can actually see them. But there's one here and one here. And if I put them together, it looks like one, but it's really two. Right, so if I hold on to one, what's going to happen to the other one? Right, it's just going to fall down just like that. Okay, but now let's glue them together. What can we use for glue? Yeah, we can just use some water. Do we have water right here? Yeah, we got water right here. All right, so here's some water on this transparency. Not a lot of water. Most of it just ran right off. And then I'll put these two transparencies together like this. Okay. Now, do you believe that I have both transparencies right here? At least the people in the front can see that there's actually two of them. All right, so I'm holding both of them. But now I'm going to let go of one, and what's going to happen to the other one? It's just going to stick together. And what's the only thing I added to this?
Water.
I didn't add any glue or anything to it. Okay. And as a matter of fact, what does that surface tension feel like? Go ahead, grab the corner of, which one am I not holding on to? This one right here. I'm not holding on to that one. Hold that one right there. All right, and I'll pull. I'll pull. That's pretty amazing. I could almost like lift you out of your seat. Okay. But if I pull them apart like that, if I shear them apart, I can separate them. So surface tension is a very strong force, and you have water in your alveoli. If the walls of the alveoli were to come together like this, guess what would happen if there was water in there? Well, they would never inflate again because they'd be stuck together because water is acting like a glue. So your body defeats the surface tension by secreting a substance that's very much like soap. And it's called surfactant. And it's secreted by the type 2 cell up over there. It's a phospholipid compound. And it makes water slippery so that the alveoli can actually inflate. Okay, and why does an alveolus come back to its original shape again? What's the structural component around an alveolus that allows for the compression of an alveolus when you're exhaling? That's those elastic fibers, right? So the elastic fibers bring it together, but an alveolus can inflate again because it has surfactant, that those cells are producing surfactant. And those cells only mature when an individual is faced with a stressful situation, all right? So especially newborn babies, and for a newborn baby, there probably isn't anything more stressful than parturition, than being born. And that's what stimulates the secretion of surfactant in a newborn baby's lungs. So if they're not born naturally, maybe by cesarean section, that's something that we always have to be concerned about, that those type 2 cells start secreting surfactant right away so that these newborn babies can have normal pulmonary function. And if it's a premature baby, then these type 2 cells, right, aren't mature enough and they don't produce surfactant. So premature babies have an additional challenge, right? Their lungs don't even inflate. So what do we do for somebody whose lungs aren't inflating? Okay, put them in an incubator, right? And have them breathe a higher than normal oxygen concentration, and that helps compensate for their decreased ability to inflate their lungs because they're not producing surfactant right here. All right, and surfactant just means surface active agent. That's where that term comes from. Okay. And you probably were familiar with that because I bet you were doing dishes at home one day and you had a couple plates, okay, or saucers that had some water between them and you tried to separate them and you probably couldn't even hardly separate them, right? Because that water really does act like a glue. Okay. So we want to consider what the membrane is that is separating the blood that's in a capillary with the substances that are in the air in the alveolus. And that's what we call a respiratory membrane, the respiratory membrane. has got, generally accepted, it's got three parts to it, but I actually want you to remember that there's four parts to the respiratory membrane. All right, so let's start with air inside the alveolus. Remember, we want oxygen to go from the air in the alveolus into the blood because our mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. Oxygen has to diffuse first through that very small layer, very thin layer, that prevents the alveoli from collapsing or sticking together. What's that layer again called? Or what's that chemical compound called? Surfactant, right? So that's what's kind of missing in this diagram right here. Don't forget there's a layer of surfactant right here that oxygen has to diffuse through. Then it's got to move through the wall of the alveolus, and that's just a simple squamous epithelium. And then there's a small interstitial space, a very thin interstitial space, and then there's the wall of the capillary, and that wall of the capillary is very thin as well. So those are the four components that make up the respiratory membrane. And even though there's those four components, it's still very, very thin, so diffusion takes place easily. All right, so surfactant, wall of the capillary, interstitial space, wall of the alveolus, interstitial space, and then wall of the capillary. Right here. Those are the four components. Okay. Well, the next thing that we're going to talk about, which is kind of a review, is the membrane, the membrane around the lungs. And remember that there are two main kinds of membranes in your body. There are mucous membranes and serous membranes. What the heck is a mucous membrane? What's a mucous membrane? It lines a cavity, what? That's open to the outside world. Like your oral cavity has a mucous membrane, nasal cavity, reproductive tract has a mucous membrane, digestive tract, mucous membrane, because they're all open to the outside world. But the cavity that the lungs are in is not open to the outside world. The alveoli are open to the outside world, but not the outside surface of the lung. They're inside a cavity. What cavity are the lungs in? That's a pleural cavity, yeah, the right and left pleural cavity, okay? And any cavity has got a membrane on it, and since it's not open to the outside world, it's a serous membrane. And can you remember what's something about a serous membrane? How many parts does it have? It's got three parts, okay? So the first part is the part that lines the cavity, which I see right here. Right, so this is what we call the parietal pleural membrane. And then there's another membrane that sits right on the surface of the lungs. That's what we call the visceral pleural membrane. And there's a space between them. And that's just the serous plate, a serous space, or sometimes we call that the pleural cavity. All right, the pleural cavity in there. And it's filled with fluid. Okay. Now this kind of fluid is a little bit different than the fluids inside the lungs, because the way that we breathe is by changing the dimension of the thoracic cavity, by moving our thoracic cage up and out. All right, and we actually would like for the wall of the thoracic cavity to pull on the lungs. Well, how can you ensure that when you move the wall of the thoracic cavity that it's going to pull on the lungs? What can you put in this space right here, the pleural cavity, what can you put in that pleural cavity to make sure that when the thoracic cage moves, that it actually pulls on the lungs? How about water? Because water acts like a glue, right? That glues the surface of the lung to the thoracic cavity. So when the thoracic cavity expands, right, that pulls on the lungs and helps the lungs expand as well. Okay, so you have surfactant in the alveoli, but you can't have any surfactant in the pleural space because then it will detach from the lung will detach itself from the thoracic cavity. Okay, so know these different divisions of the pleural membrane. Okay. So that pleural cavity has a watery substance in it, not surfactant. It acts like a lubricant, so things can slide a little bit, but because of surface tension, it acts to couple or attach the lungs to the thoracic cage. All right. Well, what about breathing? Inspiration is due to the enlargement of the thoracic cavity. All right, so the volume of the thoracic cavity expands using muscles. And there are two kinds of breathing. There's quiet breathing and forced breathing. Quiet breathing is due primarily to contraction of the diaphragm, which depresses the diaphragm. So let's look at this picture right here. So we see thoracic cavity and then abdominal cavity. What is that thing that's separating the thoracic cavity from the abdominal cavity? That's the diaphragm. And this diaphragm right here is in a relaxed state. And what kind of shape does it have? Does it look dome-shaped or does it look flat? It's dome-shaped when it's relaxed. So the diaphragm has this very pronounced dome shape to it, but when it contracts, it flattens out. So this end starts to pull on this end over here, and when it flattens out, look what happens to the volume of the thoracic cavity. Everything that's in white right here now turns into the space inside the thoracic cavity. So the thoracic cavity actually enlarges. And when that happens, the pressure inside the lungs decreases. And when pressure inside the lungs decrease, that's the force, the driving force that allows for air to go into the lungs. Okay, so I have a little model right here to help you show to help show that. So here's a little model of some lungs. What are the lungs? These little balloons. And this little glass dome right here is the thoracic cage. And this nice elastic rubber material right here, this is the that's the diaphragm. And there's your trachea. Okay, right there, the little hole in the stopper. Okay, so there's your lungs. So normally the diaphragm is what? It's curved. So I'm pushing in a little bit. All right, so what can you tell me about the lungs? Do they look inflated or collapsed?
Collapsed.
They're collapsed. And then when you inhale, you contract the diaphragm. And what happens to the diaphragm? It moves inferiorly, like this, and watch what happens to the lungs. What happened to them? Anything?
Inflated.
They inflated. Because the volume increased, and when the volume increased, the pressure decreases, and then when you exhale, this would happen. The diaphragm goes back to its original location because there's elasticity is a property of muscles, too. When they contract, they go back to their original location. All right, and air leaves the lungs. And don't forget, the alveoli have elastic tissue in them as well, so that when the diaphragm relaxes, they just deflate normally on their own. Okay, so you don't need very many muscles for expiration during quiet breathing, only inspiration. Okay, so the other thing maybe you don't have a feel for, and that is how a fluid will move through space according to pressure. How will fluid move how can like air move from one part of this room to another part of the room? Or why is wind blowing outside? Okay, so there's got to be a difference in pressure from one part of the room to another, or one part of the country or another, and either a liquid or a gas, both of those are fluids, will move from a high pressure to a low pressure. They won't go backwards. Okay, so in the lungs, air flows in because the pressure in the air is high, and when you contract the diaphragm, the pressure inside the thoracic cage decreases, and that forms a pressure gradient, so air goes into the lungs. And exhalation, on the other hand, when the muscles relax, right, the volume of the thoracic cage decreases, so that increases the pressure inside the lungs compared to the air, and so then air is expelled from the lungs. That's during quiet breathing. All right, what about during forced breathing? Okay, forced breathing, contraction of the pectoralis minor muscle is important. External, this is inspiration still. For forced breathing, for inspiration, all right, the pectoralis muscle is attached to your superior ribs, and when it contracts, it does what? It lifts the ribs up, all right? And that expands the thoracic cage. External intercostals lift all the ribs up and out, both in an anterior dimension and laterally as well, increasing the volume of the thoracic cage. Sternocleidomastoid helps, and the serratus anterior helps as well. And all of these elevate the ribs and the sternum as well. Okay, so that's during forced breathing. All right, expiration. That's due to shrinkage of the thoracic cavity. All right, the diaphragm just goes back to its resting length, which is longer than when it's contracted, and it forms that nice dome. All right, but expiration is also due to those elastic fibers. surrounding each of those alveoli. So that's just during quiet breathing. So I got another little example for you. Okay, I've got, I think I got this bag right on Cinco de Mayo, but I brought it in. Okay, and I don't know where I got these balloons from. But let's pretend that these are both alveoli. And you could tell me which one is a model of a healthy lung and which one is going to be a model for a diseased lung. Okay, so what does an alveolus do? It expands, right? It's going to expand. So you got to put air inside the alveolus. So here is an alveolus, the paper bag, and I'm going to blow some air in there. So what's going to happen to the bag when I blow into it? All right, so it's expanded, and I trap the air in there, and now I'm going to let go. What's going to happen to the bag? Is it going to go back to its original shape? Or is it just going to stay there? Okay, I let go. I didn't even have you guys know this. I didn't even have to show you that. All right, but now it's got air in there. It's still trapped because, right, there are no elastic fibers in this paper bag. Right, so this person right here, can they exhale? No, that air is trapped in their lungs. Okay, as opposed to this yellow alveolus that I have right here. All right, so let's inhale. Okay, that's good. All right, it didn't blow up in my face. That's good. Oops, sorry. Sorry. All right, so now we have air inside this alveolus. So again, you have to tell me, this is just a little quiz. Which is a better model for a healthy alveolus, this paper bag or this balloon right here? So I'm just going to let it go. Okay, and what happened to the air? It just went out. Okay, so what's a better model for a normal, healthy alveolus? A balloon, right? Because it has those elastic fibers. And so during normal quiet breathing, you should know that it is just passive, right? It's just relaxation of muscles. But for forced breathing, right, we need some other muscles to help expel air because we want it to happen more rapidly. All right, internal intercostals are important for expiration. The rectus abdominis, which is the most anterior stomach muscle right here, as well as the internal oblique and external oblique, transverse abdominis, all the abdominal muscles will compress the abdominal contents up into the diaphragm, and that's going to decrease the volume of the thoracic cavity. Okay. So that's what happens during forced breathing.
And
yeah, they are. I just want to show you under normal conditions, and then I'll talk quickly about a pathological conditions. Yeah, yeah.
Also, it's really obvious to someone with a COPD.
Uh-huh.
All their accessory muscles, they have really broad shoulders and real muscular build. They're working them out.
Yeah, because they're working, that's exactly, yeah, I think what your comment was. And so let's just look at a normal case, and then I'll just reiterate what you said. Okay, so for inspiration, under quiet breathing, the only thing that really contracts is the diaphragm. So the diaphragm moves down to this location right here. That increases the volume of the thoracic cage, decreasing the pressure. All right, so air flows into the lungs. All right, under forced breathing, okay, we use some other muscles. And so that lifts the rib cage out laterally and also lifts the sternum out anteriorly, increasing the volume of the thoracic cage. All right, so those were so for inspiration, those were the external intercostals, pectoralis minor, sorry. And what else do you have on your list? Okay, so superior muscles to the rib cage. And so when somebody has trouble breathing due to decreased pulmonary function, maybe obstruction of their lungs, that happens during emphysema, and maybe some people that suffer from asthma, okay, they're going to have to use a lot more muscles for inspiration besides their diaphragm. And what happens to a muscle when you exercise it? It gets bigger and stronger. It hypertrophies, so those muscles will get bigger and stronger, and you can notice that on somebody. All right, but also, if they have trouble exhaling, when they need muscles to exhale, all right, then what happens? And they use even more muscles to exhale. They're always sort of in forced breathing when somebody has emphysema. So they have that typical barrel-chested shape to them, a lot of musculature.
You've got to compensate for the lungs.
Yeah, because they can't exhale just by relaxing.
Right.
They actually have to force air out of their lungs using muscles. Right. Okay, so I think you should probably remember the intercostal for inspiration are the externals, and the intercostals for expiration are the internals. Okay, that's just the way it goes. You got to remember it's kind of reversed. Okay. All right, so we talked about that already. Here's the respiratory membrane control of respiration. That's in the respiratory center. And the respiratory center is in partly the pons and partly the medulla. That controls the rate and depth of respiration. There's a ventral group. That's the pacemaker. There's a dorsal respiratory group and a pontine respiratory center. This group right here, the pacemaker, the diaphragm is skeletal muscle. So it's under your voluntary control. But you don't have to consider every breath that you're taking, right? So it's the this ventral respiratory group that can take over and allow the contraction of the diaphragm even without your conscious thought. That's going to take place. So even when you're sleeping, you don't have to consciously think of what's happening to your diaphragm, so you're not going to suffocate when you fall asleep, as long as this respiratory center is functioning normally. But guess what? It doesn't always happen. For instance, if somebody has a stroke in this part of the brain, every breath that they take has to be a conscious effort. It has to be overridden by some voluntary command. And that's called Odin's curse. So you can imagine what kind of pain that would be to live with that kind of condition. So at night when you sleep, you have to be on a ventilator because you would just never breathe, or you'd be waking up all the time. All right, so the outputs from the pons and the medulla, or the respiratory center, is via the phrenic nerve to the diaphragm that I think you know from the lab. You probably even have to know where the phrenic nerve is on the nerve man model, right? And the phrenic nerve comes out of a plexus. And what's the beauty of a plexus, a nerve plexus again? Yeah, so that nerve impulses or action potentials can take alternate routes to the effector organ in case one of the origins of that nerve is damaged. You still have a way of innervating the diaphragm. And so just remember that the origins are C3, C4, and C5. And that, what's the little saying? Yeah, C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Okay, and the phrenic nerve goes to the diaphragm. So here we see the medulla and the pons. All right. And I think maybe that's one of the last pictures that I'm going to show you. All right, but where are the inputs to the respiratory center? How does the respiratory center know to help control your respiratory rate? Well, there are chemoreceptors. And so what kind of receptor is a chemoreceptor? What is it sensitive to? Yeah, to chemicals. And it's going to be sensitive to carbon dioxide, and it's going to be sensitive to hydrogen ion. Hydrogen ion is the amount of acidity that's in solution, or the alkalinity, how basic or how acidic a solution is. And we talk about acidity in terms of the pH scale. So when something gets more acidic, the pH goes down. All right, so when something's very acidic, it has a pH 1 or 2. If it's very basic, it has a pH of 8, 9, 10, or 11. And if it's absolutely neutral pH, it has a pH of 7. So the pH scale goes from 0 to 14, and right smack in the middle is neutrality, and that's a pH 7. Okay, so these chemoreceptors can monitor CO2, and they also monitor hydrogen ion concentration, or that's just a measure of pH. There are a couple receptors. There are central receptors. The central receptors are located in the medulla and the pons. Where are those at? Ooh, I went too far. Okay. The central receptors are up here in the central nervous system. These are the most sensitive receptors, and they sense increasing CO2 or decreasing pH. And when CO2 starts to build up in your body or pH starts to decrease, then the medulla is going to make a decision to send signals via the phrenic nerve all the way down to the diaphragm to cause the diaphragm to contract. All right, so these are the most powerful stimulations for inspiration, increasing CO2 and decreasing pH. Now, that's not what I thought when I was first studying physiology. I thought that your body probably would like to measure oxygen and adjust your ventilatory rate based on oxygen concentration inside your body, but that's not the most important thing. It's pH and CO2. But nonetheless, there are some chemoreceptors that measure oxygen. These are peripheral receptors in the carotid sinus and the aortic arch. Should I show you where those are? No, you know where those are, do you? Okay, well, all right, I'll show you real quick. All right, so here's the arch of the aorta, and the carotid sinus is right at the bifurcation of the internal and external carotid, right, with the common carotid artery. So here's a very special location because not only does it have chemoreceptors there, but it also has pressure receptors. That's one way that your body measures and monitors blood pressure is right here in this area. But we're talking about air perfusion of the lungs. So these are going to measure oxygen concentration. And it's only when oxygen concentration drastically is reduced. That's why I have all of these arrows right here. Right? You have to hold your breath probably for a minute or two before these chemoreceptors are going to send signals to the brain to increase ventilatory rate. But before that happens, CO2 is going to build up, pH in your body is going to decrease, and that's going to cause you to ventilate. All right, higher centers in the brain can also control respiration. Like, for instance, you can hold your breath for as long as you want, as long as is comfortable, until you pass out. All right, so you have voluntary control over your diaphragm, and then after you pass out, what's going to happen? Here, the automatic control center is going to take over, and you're going to start breathing again. Okay, so higher centers in the brain can override the automatic centers in the brain. So stimulation from the cerebral cortex, that's voluntary control. For instance, if you're playing an instrument or something, and you have to, or a singer, and you have to control your ventilatory rate, you can do that, learn to do that very easily. And it is also controlled by the hypothalamus. And this is due to emotional content that you might be experiencing. Okay, so for instance, if I said, you know, we're not going to have the final during finals week, we're going to have it after class today instead. Okay, so probably what would happen to your ventilatory rate? I could tell right now that I see a little hyperventilation in the room. Okay, so emotional content can change ventilatory rate. Proprioceptors. Ooh, who can tell me about a proprioceptor? What's a proprioceptor? Is that a special sense or a general sense? General. It's a general sense. You have them all over your body, in all your muscles and joints, tendons, right? And they measure tension or length in muscles. And as soon as you start to stimulate them, even though maybe you're not exercising, that's going to increase your ventilatory rate. So right now, if you were to move your arms and legs while sitting still, I wouldn't really consider that exercise. All right, but your body would consider that exercise because all those proprioceptors are going to be stimulated and you're going to have an urgency to breathe just like if you started running up the stairs over here. Okay, so you could actually try that. Then you have other receptors like touch, pain, and temperature. Right, so if I took a pin and poked your arm, what would happen to your ventilatory rate? It would increase, right, for sure. And if I took an ice cube and put it on your back, your ventilatory rate would increase. But probably first what would happen, you'd probably go, that's called a gasp reflex. All right? That's very hard to control. And a lot of times that results in drowning, especially around here. Yeah.
I have a quick question.
Yeah, yeah.
You ever heard of a condition known as dry drowning?
Who?
You ever heard of a condition known as dry drowning?
Dry drowning, no. I'll have to Google that one, or see me after class so you could tell me about it. That's interesting. Yeah?
So if somebody drowns,
yeah?
They pass out from holding their breath, and then they start breathing.
Yeah. So. Yeah, as soon as you can hold your breath if you don't want to inhale water, but as soon as you pass out, that automatically will take over and you're going to inhale water. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that I'll tell you how that happens to almost professional divers sometimes, but This gasp reflex right here is very powerful. So if you were to fall in the ocean, maybe you went fishing around here because the ocean's pretty cold. If you fall in, guess what? Guess what's going to happen to you as soon as you hit that cold water? You go, and if you fall in, your head is usually underwater. So that usually ends up in drowning. And I remember about maybe 10 years ago, there's a company called Hornblower Yachts. They have outfit in Newport Beach and Marina Del Rey. And they're really big boats. They're not really ocean-going boats. They just stay in the harbor, and they tool around through the harbor, and it's pretty to look at the marina at night. And they usually hold weddings, you know, and Christmas parties and things like that. And one year, somebody was holding a Christmas party, an office Christmas party, in Marina Del Rey on one of these Hornblower yachts, and it caught on fire. And they lost engine power, and this big boat that had probably a couple hundred people on it was stuck in the middle of the harbor in Marina Del Rey, and they didn't have any lifeboats. And so they had to, and they told everybody, well, you have to leave the boat because it's on fire, you know, otherwise you're going to burn up. So they had everybody jump off the boat right in the middle of the harbor. You know, you're there in your evening gown and a suit or something. I go, wow, how rude that would be. And it's like the last thing that I would think of doing is jumping in the harbor in the middle of the night, right, in December. And I read the report and nobody drowned. And I was just so amazed and actually, you know, thankful that nobody drowned, because you hear of this gasp reflex. All right, but the good thing was, guess what saved everybody's life? I mean, they froze almost to death. But they put on life preservers. That's right, they put on life preservers, so they had enough life preservers on the boat, so they dressed everybody up in life preserver, and when you fall in, that kind of helps float you so your head doesn't go underwater. But it would be a long time before I would jump into the harbor at night, but it might have had to be a really hot boat. Okay. The other thing is, there are a lot of people that like to go fishing with a spear gun, and they call that free diving. Where do I want to go? I want to go here. Yeah, free diving. All right, and so they don't have scuba tanks or anything, and so they'll just hyperventilate. All right, when you hyperventilate, guess what you get rid of? You get rid of a lot of CO2 when you hyperventilate, all right? And CO2 is what the driving force for inspiration. But if you hyperventilate, guess what? You're not going to have that feeling in your body that you have to breathe because you've excreted a lot of carbon dioxide. So they hyperventilate, and then they dive down like 20, 30. I have friends that go fishing down at 30 feet without tanks on, and I'm just kind of amazed that they can dive so deep, okay? But you're still exercising. What are you using up? You don't have the sense that you're running out of oxygen, but guess what you're using when you're kicking around and swimming around underwater? You're using up oxygen, and you need oxygen to maintain consciousness, right? And so those people can trick themselves into thinking they don't need to breathe by hyperventilating, and they'll dive real, real deep. They never get an urgency to breathe, and they run out of oxygen, and they pass out. And they're maybe 20 or 30 feet underwater, then what happens? Well, that's it. Yeah, then you drown. Okay, that's really a terrible scenario. They never come to. So that's just a little trick that you got to be careful of. Do we have any free divers in here? Yeah? You heard of that before? Of hyperventilating? How it can put
shallow
you.
Water blackout.
Shallow water blackout.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the professional spear fishermen dive over 100 feet.
Over 100 feet, yeah, it's pretty incredible. They just don't. Okay. They will do it. Doubt to give them a little edge. But it's really strange to be down there with scuba equipment and all of a sudden you just see some guys swimming by you with no tanks on. That's really wild. Okay, so that's it for respiratory system. You know, and then there's something else I forgot. It had to do with the vascular system. Okay, and it's in the study guide. I told you I wanted you to be able to label the blood vessels on figure. Who's got the figure number? It's 19.12. Okay, 19.12. These are arteries. All right, but the figure that I put in the study guide is not this figure. It was what? 19.23, which is veins. All right, so this is not the one I want you to know. They look similar, all right, except One is red and the other is blue. And so, you know, I didn't pay close enough attention to it when I put it in your study guide. I didn't notice that that I put the blue one in. I meant to put the red one in. So I want you to know the arteries, right? The paired branches coming off the aorta and the unpaired branches off the aorta, and not the veins. So make sure you catch that. And if you see anybody that's not in class today, make sure that they see that, okay? Okay. So this is for sure the one I want, 19.12. So I'll try to remember to send everybody an email regarding that one. Okay. So that's it for respiratory system. All right, so next, what are we going to do next? Digestive tract, I think. Digestion. This is, I think this is everybody's favorite chapter, really. Well, you'll see. Let's see, I want to view this. I'll view it in this format, I think. Okay. And that's chapter 22. Ah, here's the digestive tract. Okay, I think it's because the digestive tract is so disgusting when we talk about it, that it's kind of fun to talk about it. And, you know, if you deal with the digestive tract every day professionally, you develop an excellent sense of humor. It's just really excellent. And, you know, you can't say that everybody in a group of people all behave the same way. Like, what would be your impression of somebody that's a bird watcher? There are people that just go out and watch birds, watch nature. Boring, right? Or well-mannered, really laid back. Okay, and so I kind of thought that too, but I went out and I tried to, there's a report in a newspaper that there was this one owl that was coming through town that's not seen around here for hundreds of years, right? And so I kind of went out to take a look at it, but the bird watchers were out there looking, and I mean, it was like elbow to elbow, people were almost fighting to get a look at this bird, and I go, well, this goes to show you again, you can't just stereotype, you know, everybody in a group as being one way or the other, okay? So that's just a preface to what I'm going to say about gastroenterologists, people that deal with the digestive tract all the time, okay? You're probably going to end up in some kind of clinical service, I would guess, and you're going to have continuing medical education hours all the time. You're going to be educated. And if where you're at, if there's ever a seminar on the digestive system, you got to go and listen to it, because most of these people have just a fantastic sense of humor and a knowledge of the inner workings of your body that you usually don't really appreciate, but their sense of humor on average is really great. All right, so take advantage of these people if anybody ever gives a talk on like the large intestine or something. They're great. They're great people just to go and meet and listen to. Okay, as opposed to what like surgeons or something like that. Okay, but again, you can't typify a particular person by the whole group. Okay, so here's your digestive tract, and it starts at the mouth, oral cavity, and then food moves into the esophagus, to the stomach, and then into the small intestine. Three divisions of the small intestine. The proximal division next to the stomach is the duodenum, the middle division is the jejunum, and then the distal division is the ileum. The ileum empties into the large intestine, which we see right here, and the large intestine, the origin of it right here is the cecum. And hanging off the cecum is this little vestigial organ that we don't use for digestion anymore, but it's an important lymphatic organ. That's the appendix. You got the ascending colon, transverse colon, descending, and sigmoid. And then we have the rectum and anal canal, and then the anus. And food has taken this whole trip right through there for digestion and absorption. There are some accessory structures that are necessary for your digestive tract, namely salivary glands. And salivary glands are important because that lubricates food, allows that bolus of food to move down the esophagus into the stomach. The liver is important because it produces something that emulsifies fats, namely bile salts or bile, and that is being secreted by the liver all the time. When you're in a fasted state, that bile doesn't normally enter the small intestine. It's stored in the gallbladder. But when you're in a fed state, bile then is secreted in large amounts from the gallbladder into the small intestine. And the other organ that's major, another major accessory organ, is the pancreas right here. So here's the pancreas. Here's the tail of the pancreas, the head of the pancreas. The pancreas has a number of jobs, but in terms of digestion, it secretes digestive enzymes into the small intestine, and it joins the duct from the gallbladder right at the small intestine. So that's kind of an overview of the digestive tract. And again, the digestive tract is open to the outside world, right? So it is lined with a mucous membrane, not a serous membrane. Now, on the outside of the digestive tract, right, it's in the abdominal or pelvic cavity, and so that is not open to the outside world, so that's lined with a serous membrane. And the serous membrane we call the peritoneum, right, and that has three divisions. There's a visceral division, there's serous fluid, and then the parietal division of that serous membrane as well. Okay, so these are all the organs that you got to know something about. And, of course, we want to know a lot about layers of things. Just like layers of blood vessels, we want to become familiar of layers of the digestive tract. Three main layers are the mucosa. This is the inner lining, the deepest lining of the digestive tract. That's the mucous membrane. Then you have submucosa, the muscularis. Guess what the muscularis has? Muscle, right? And then the serosa. Okay, so the mucosa is an epithelium, stratified squamous, or it could be a simple columnar, depending on where in the digestive tract it is. Stratified squamous, for instance, in the oral cavity, and I think one of the very first labs, you were able to look at some of those cells because a stratified squamous epithelium is specialized for being in environments that are very abrasive, so they're designed to fall off or slough off. But that's okay because the underlying layers then replace the ones that fall off, just like your skin. But the cells of your mouth are not keratinized like your skin is keratinized, right? The epithelium in your mouth is not tough and hard like skin. Lamina propria is in the mucosa. That's loose connective tissue. It has glands and there's capillaries in there. And also there are vessels that can absorb lipids. What's the name of those vessels that can absorb lipids? That's a lacteal, all right? The lacteal is that vessel within the lamina propria for absorption of lipids. And the mucosa can have a small amount of muscle tissue, which we call the muscularis mucosae. And I'll show you why that's important a little bit. The submucosa is loose connective tissue with large arteries, veins, lymphatic vessels, and also in this layer, it's highly innervated with a plexus that we call the submucosal plexus. It's part of the myenteric plexus. It has parasympathetic motor neurons and sensory neurons. And sensory neurons in the digestive tract will measure stretch. Because when you eat something, your digestive tract extends, it expands. And so these nerve fibers monitor that stretching action. And that is stimulatory to the smooth muscle of that particular region. It's going to cause smooth muscle to contract whenever it stretches. The muscularis externa, all right, these are stronger muscles than what we find in the lamina propria and the inner layer, this is the deep one, that's the circular smooth muscle, and the outer, the most superficial, that's a longitudinal smooth muscle. And somebody showed me a pretty nice model that you guys have in lab that shows that, and I think maybe even in your book. You have a pretty good picture. And there's another myenteric plexus within the muscularis layer, which controls the contraction of this smooth muscle in these two different layers right here. All right, so don't forget, parasympathetic is stimulatory. Sympathetic innervation inhibits the motions and secretions of the digestive tract. So this is opposite compared to what you're familiar with in terms of the heart control. All right, so let's see what we got. Here we go. Here's a picture that shows the layers. So the most superficial layer, right, is the visceral peritoneum, right? That's actually the serosa around the intestines. And it's kind of just a slippery membrane that allows the intestines to move a little bit, but it also holds the intestines in place. Okay, and so let's start at the very inner tube right here. So here is the lumen of the digestive tract. So the deepest layer is going to be the mucosa. So here's the mucosa. This is the epithelium that's on the lining the mucosa. And then the lamina propria, and then the muscularis right here. Okay, then in the submucosa, we have glands, we have larger blood vessels, we have a nerve plexus. All right, so here is the submucosa, and then the muscularis layer right here, this deep layer. Notice the arrangement of these muscles. This is the circular muscle right here. So this tube is kind of moving in and out of the plane of the blackboard. And then the longitudinal muscles are these along the long axis of the tube. Right, these are circular. So two different kinds of muscles that are responsible for moving material along the digestive tract. So let's consider motility of material through the digestive tract. We have peristalsis and segmentation, two kinds of motions. Right, peristalsis is the propulsion of material from mouth to anus. Right, we call that antegrade. From one part of the digestive tract to the other due to coordination between circular and longitudinal smooth muscles. Segmentation, on the other hand, is the moving forward as well as backwards, and that's what we call retrograde propulsion. So this chops and churns and mixes materials together for digestion. All right, so what do these two things look like? Okay. All right, so here we see like contraction of circular muscle, the circular smooth muscle, and then it's going to propagate, okay, to more and more distal segments of the digestive tract, and that's going to push this bolus of food, okay, in an antegrade fashion through the digestive tract. And this could even happen, for instance, down the esophagus when you swallow something, right? This is how a bolus of food is going to end up in the stomach, right? The lower two-thirds of the esophagus are under autonomic control. So once you get food down to that region right there, it's going to end up in your stomach. You no longer have control of it if everything is operating correctly. I had a boss one time that didn't always operate correctly. He would swallow something and a bolus of food would almost get to his stomach and something strange would happen, and the bolus, then the segment or the peristalsis would move the food back up almost to his mouth, and then it would stop, reverse itself, and start to push food back down to the stomach. It'd get almost to the stomach and push it back up to the mouth. And so this, when he would swallow something sometimes, it would get stuck there for about a minute, going up and down, up and down. And it was really weird. And he made some really strange sounds when that was happening. Okay, so I think that had to do with overdosing on caffeine and nicotine. Okay, so it was pretty irritating to the smooth muscle. So that's peristalsis. It usually works, just antegrade. All right, but segmentation, on the other hand, okay, here you can see a bolus of food, but we got three boluses. One here, one here, and one here. Okay, and what happens here is now this, it's going to contract in this region right here, so it's going to separate this bolus out. Okay, so it's going to move up over here. This one is going to stay at this location down over here. Right, this bolus is going to be broken in half, right, and shared with the lower part of this one over here. So now these two are being mixed together, and subsequent contractions, okay, it's just going to mix these different boluses of food so that it's nice and homogeneous, but they're not actually going to transit through the digestive tract. They're just going to get chopped up into smaller and smaller pieces and mixed with whatever is in the intestine. So this would be segmentation. This would be peristalsis. Okay, so let's talk about the function. Let's start, the function of the mouth. Let's just start with the mouth real quick. Well, you have teeth in there, right, that chew food up. You got salivary glands. Those salivary glands lubricate the food so it can move as a bolus down into the stomach. But the salivary glands also produce a little bit of an amylase, that's an enzyme. Anytime you hear a word with ASE on the end of it, that means an enzyme is going to have some kind of activity in the body. And amylase will break starch down into simple sugars. All right, so what the heck is starch? Anybody know what a nice name of a sugar is?
Glucose.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of myself. Glucose. That's what we call a monosaccharide. And that's a very important metabolite, energy metabolite for us. Okay, that's where you make ATP from. And we can store glucose in our body by binding it to other glucoses. As a matter of fact, we can take thousands of glucose molecules and bind them together, and that's what produces a compound we call starch. Okay? Well, you know what? We don't do that. This is what happens in plants. Okay? So what we do is, okay, we make it a little bit more branched looking. All right, but it's still just glucose. Okay, so if we take a bunch of glucoses and put them together, this is what we call glycogen. This is glycogen. So glycogen is a storage form of glucose, so is starch. So when you eat starch, what are you really eating? You're just eating, yeah, carbohydrates or glucose, right? So what do you have in your diet that is starch? That's just glucose. Potatoes, for instance, pasta, right? Bread, anything made out of wheat is starch. And so, yeah, when you eat a slice of bread, that's like eating a sugar cube almost, right? But it's just in a little bit different form. Okay. So there is an enzyme from a salivary gland that can start to break starch down into glucose. So we have starch in our diet, but that's not how we store it in our bodies necessarily. We store it in a little bit different form, namely glycogen. All right, but typically, how long do you chew food for? Is the function of amylase, salivary amylase, very important for our digestive processes? Okay, how long do you chew your food for?
5 seconds.
Yeah, maybe 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, and then 2 seconds, and then you swallow it, right? It goes to your stomach, and there that amylase is inactivated. All right, so salivary amylase does not perform a very important function in our bodies. Okay, because its time of operation is very, very short. But at least I have to mention it to you, okay, that it does happen. All right, so then that food is in the stomach. All right, the function of the stomach is for storing and mixing. Well, what kind of motion produces mixing? Is it peristalsis or segmentation?
Segmentation.
It's segmentation. All right, so notice in this list right here, you don't see absorption of nutrients. You see absorption right here? The stomach hardly absorbs anything whatsoever. Okay? And the other important function is storing. The most important part of the digestive tract for digestion and absorption of nutrients is the small intestine. And it's the job of the stomach to hold on to food that you eat and give it to the small intestine at the right moment so that the small intestine can do its job completely and absorb all the nutrients out of it. So if all of the food that you ate went into the small intestine wouldn't have time to digest it and absorb it, and you would be losing a lot of nutrients through the large intestine and even out of your body. So the stomach holds on to material and waits until the rest of the digestive tract is able to work on it properly. Those are the two main important functions. So there is a little initial digestion of proteins with an enzyme called pepsin. And pepsin has to work at a very acidic condition or a very low pH. So the stomach also secretes hydrochloric acid. So the stomach is very acidic because of that. Other secretions are of intrinsic factor. This is important because intrinsic factor is necessary for you to absorb vitamin B12. And vitamin B12 is necessary to make red blood cells, for instance. And you actually lose about 2.5 to 3 million red blood cells every second, and you have to make that many every second, otherwise you become anemic. So vitamin B12 is extremely important so that you don't become anemic. All right, so all of these things together, the hydrochloric acid and pepsin and intrinsic factor and water that's secreted into the stomach, that's what we call gastric juice. Very, very acidic. And when gastric juice mixes with food, that produces a compound that we call chyme. The other kind of cell, cells that line the stomach, that actually help protect the wall of the stomach from hydrochloric acid and from pepsin, are goblet cells. They secrete mucus that lines the mucosa and that helps protect the mucosa. All right, so the cells that actually secrete hydrochloric acid and intrinsic factor are what we call the parietal cells. And the cells that secrete pepsin are the chief cells. All right, but the chief cells, when they synthesize pepsin, if it was active inside the cells, then pepsin would actually digest the cells that was producing that enzyme. So the cells produce an inactive form of pepsin called pepsinogen. And these cells also produce a little gastric lipase that help. What's a substrate for lipase? And how can you tell that's an enzyme? Because there's an ASE on the end of this word, right? That means that it is an enzyme. And the first part of the word tells you what the substrate is, and that is lipids. And lipids are fats. So this is an enzyme that will help digest fats. Okay. There's another trick, another nomenclature trick. When you look at pepsinogen right here, I see that there's also a special suffix at the end of this word, ogen. Whenever you see a word that has ogen on it, that means that it is an inactive form of the active enzyme, and it can become activated when it gets to its proper location or under the proper circumstances. So anytime you see ogen at the end of a word, you should know that's the inactive form, but it's ready to go to work. It can be converted very quickly. Some other examples would be, for instance, like angiotensinogen. We haven't talked about that yet, but anytime you hear that ogen, you should immediately know that's an inactive form. Okay. All right, so all of these cells secrete about 1.5 liters of gastric juice into the stomach every day. That's almost like a big Coke bottle worth of fluid. All right, so that's a huge amount of fluid that your body is losing, because that fluid is in your digestive tract. It's no longer really inside your body. It's just in a tube moving through your body. And there are undifferentiated stem cells in the mucosa, which renew the gastric epithelium every 3 to 5 days. So the epithelium is being renewed about once a week, because it's in a very rough environment. All these digestive enzymes and acetic acid take its toll on the mucosa, and the epithelium is rejuvenated very, very quickly. All right, so let's see if we can find something on the stomach right here, some pictures of the stomach. All right, teeth. Now, your book does a pretty good job with teeth. You might want to look at that. Sometimes it's hard to find a good reference of teeth, but I'm not going to test you on the teeth, but all the different kinds of teeth. All right, so here is the stomach. Here's the esophagus coming down, and you can see that it's kind of a strange-looking pouch for material, and that just means that it's going to help store material that we've eaten. This area right here is what the superior part of the stomach is, what we call the fundus. So when gastric juice is mixed with food that we eat, it usually produces a lot of gas. The gas ends up in the fundic region right here until it's resorbed. The body of the stomach is right here. This is where most of the food is stored, and as it moves its way into the small intestine, it passes through the pyloric region right here. And there are regions of strong circular smooth muscles between the stomach and the small intestine. We call that the pyloric sphincter. Right, and that helps regulate the passage of material from the stomach into the small intestine. There's a similar kind of smooth muscle between the stomach and the esophagus. Sometimes we call that the cardiac sphincter. It's not nearly as strong or as large, so sometimes this cardiac sphincter is fairly leaky, depending on body position. Like when somebody lays down, It means that chyme can move back up into the esophagus, and the esophagus can't protect itself from the acidic contents of the stomach, and that burns the esophagus and eventually will erode the esophagus away. We call that, GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease, yeah. Okay, and sometimes people have to sleep on an incline, and people, I guess, that have it really bad even have to sleep sitting up so that that chyme doesn't enter back up into the esophagus, and there's different ways clinically that maybe that can be dealt with besides just changing your sleeping habits. Here's a lesser curvature and the greater curvature of the stomach. All right, and the interior of the stomach. Notice that instead of just having a longitudinal and circular smooth muscle, we actually have three different layers. There's an additional oblique layer because the stomach really is specialized for segmentation kinds of motions or mixing gastric juice with food that we eat. All right, so remember we were talking about folds and the importance of folds, increasing the surface area of things for exchange. And the stomach is highly folded as well. But these folds are called rugae, but the stomach hardly absorbs anything at all. And these folds are there just to allow the stomach to, distend, to expand when you eat a lot. So it's very apropos that we're talking about it today, because tomorrow we're all probably going to give our stomachs quite a workout, okay, during Thanksgiving. So these rugae just allow the stomach to expand. And as a matter of fact, I've heard, I think I have to go back to, okay, close your eyes a second, I got to go back to the very first slide. Okay, right here. All right. I've heard from reputable sources that people can eat so much that the stomach, which is located, in the superior abdominal cavity, can expand all the way down to the urinary bladder when you overeat without rupturing. So I don't recommend that you do that tomorrow, but I'm sure we all could if we put our mind to it.
We actually saw that in the lab with our cat.
In your cat?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Wow. Okay, big stomach. Okay. All right, well, refrain from doing that. Okay, so that's the job of the rugae in the stomach. Okay, so you also have here's what the lining of the stomach looks like. There are glands that secrete the materials into the stomach. This is the opening of a gland to the interior of the stomach. We call this a pit. Okay, and this is where all the parietal and chief cells are located that secrete materials through the gastric pits into the lumen of the stomach. And hydrochloric acid is necessary to convert pepsinogen, which is inactive, into pepsin. Okay. All right, so after Thanksgiving, remind me to start, maybe I'll just make a note, small intestine. Let's start small intestine. But if you want to look at stuff, look over your notes over the weekend, and I'll put answers to the homework all up there in Blackboard for you. Okay.